Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. Today, we are talking tarot, and I've got with us Mr. Michael Hughes. Thank you for being here.
Hey, great to be here, as always.
Well, Michael, now, I wanted to kind of do a good overview for tarot, and you're kind of the most trustworthy guy I know. And I say that because I've come across some tarot people before that were a little bit, shady?
Yeah, well, you know, when you get into this kind of stuff, sometimes you run into some shady people or, you know, even in my case, less shady than just people who make a lot of very uninformed sort of proclamations and statements that aren't backed up by, you know, history. So I teach tarot, and one of the first things I teach in my classes is the history, because I think if you know the history, if you know where the cards come from, then you're not going to, you know, make the sorts of mistakes that people make and propagate really just the BS that's kind of been circulating around since forever.
So let's start with that history. So what was it that was the beginning of what we call tarot?
Yeah, well, to understand the beginning of tarot, you have to understand the beginning of cards, playing cards, because that's where it came from. And if you want to have cards, you need paper, and paper originated in China. So it's in China where we see the very first playing cards, and some of the oldest sort of decks that we know of, or what turned into cards, were these little like sort of strips of paper or cardstock that were kind of like on like almost like a three-ring binder. You know, we've seen evidence of that sort of thing. But interestingly to me is that even from the earliest decks that we know of, the Chinese playing cards, which when, you know, cards, the paper and cardstock first originated and was produced in large quantities, even those early cards, they had four suits. So through history, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, there have always been four suits. So for some reason, you know, either because that's the way they were originally and that's the way they spread as cards circulated through different cultures, or just because humans like dividing things into four you know, like the four seasons or something like that, or the four elements. It's always been four suits in decks of cards. So what happened is the Chinese started making paper, and then paper making was picked up elsewhere as it spread. And some of the earliest decks that we have are Islamic decks. And there's one called the Mamluk, M-A-M-L-U-K, the Mamluk deck. The Mamluk deck, which originated around the Mamluk dynasty, was an Egyptian dynasty from about the middle of the 13th century to the early 16th century. So they were like a really long, long-lived dynasty in what is now Egypt. And they kicked the Crusaders out of the Holy Land. So that was kind of their claim to fame. So the Mamluk deck is really beautiful. You can look this up and see these incredible cards that were preserved from that era. And there are four suits, like I said earlier. There are scimitars, which are like curved swords, coins, polo sticks, and cups. And for those who know tarot, you know, you'll recognize those suits quite clearly. Now, as the Mamluk cards started spreading through southern Europe and making their way north, those swords, curved swords, turned into straight swords because the Europeans used straight swords. The coins kind of stayed the same, and the clubs stayed the same, and the cups stayed the same. And you can watch as they spread through Europe and eventually made it to Germany and France and England, that they became more abstract, these suits. So like what was originally the scimitar and then the sword, by the time it got to Germany, those suits became spades, the spades that we know now. The coins became diamonds. The clubs became clubs, like the little, you know, sort of clovery looking club thing that we have now. And the cups became hearts. So you can see as these cards spread and people started making their own cards, they started making them abstract. And that's where we have our you know, very abstract symbols on our playing cards today. So that, I love that. I teach that in my class, and I have a little chart I pulled from a book by a guy named Robert Place, who wrote a really great book on tarot. He's a tarot historian and scholar. And you can see those symbols changing. Like in Switzerland, instead of a coin, it became a bell. And Germany as well. So nowadays, you can, if you're playing cards in Germany, sometimes you'll see that instead of a coin or a diamond, it will be a bell. Or instead of a spade, it will be an acorn. So various regions change the symbols around and things like that. Essentially what happened, these cards are spreading and people are enjoying playing card games with them. And then around the 15th century, so in northern Italy, around 1430 or something like that, we start seeing a deck of playing cards with these symbols on them, but we see another suit entirely added to these cards. And people were just playing around with this idea. They were developing new games. So they just started adding these a different suit. In some cases, it might be different birds. It might be flowers and things like that, or gods, Greek gods, things like that. It was because it was the Renaissance. It was a classical, it was the Renaissance era in Europe. And so what happened is someone came up with the idea of adding these triumphs or trump cards, they're called. And they added this extra suit and they came up with these really evocative, iconic images. And those are the images that transformed a little bit over time, but in a lot of ways stayed the same, that are the 22 major cards of the tarot, sometimes called the major arcana. And those are those cards that really grab people, like Death and the Hermit and the Hanged Man and Judgment, the Sun and the Moon, Justice, those cards that are just really have become iconic. And we see them in movies, we see them in TV shows, we see them in books and art and things like that. So really, tarot cards come from playing cards. A lot of people for a long time were saying and writing in books that the playing cards came from the tarot and the tarot was first, but that's completely untrue. Tarot grew out of playing cards, and it grew out of people playing games with regular playing cards with images on them and then deciding they wanted some extra cards. And this was the game that they were playing in Northern Italy was called Tarocchi. And we don't know where that name came from or why that name in particular became associated with this game, but that's where it all started. So, you know, I remember, and again, like why I teach the history of tarot first is because there's so much misinformation out there. I remember reading when I was younger that tarot was Egyptian, from it meant royal road and things like that. But it's not. It's from Tarocchi. It's an Italian word, and it's an Italian game. And it was a game like bridge it's a trick taking game. It was called. So you would bet money and things like that. So it was a group game that people would play, and they would bet money. And it was mostly played like in the courts and the royalty, because first of all, there was no mass production. There was no mass printing production back then. So these early decks, some of the earliest decks that we have and in existence from that era, are hand painted. They're like really beautiful, hand painted individual decks. So, you know, it's not like Joe Schmo the peasant, you know, can get a deck of these cards and play with his family. This was a courtly pastime. It was a pastime of the aristocracy.
What was the kind of the point, but like, so they were playing kind of games. And why would they add the trump cards? Like, what was there a point to that, or do we know?
Yeah, there was a point. And those cards, another myth that brings up another myth that I debunk is that the tarot is somehow, you know, pagan in its origin. It isn't. If you look at the earliest decks, they are Christian, because the time was a Christian era. You know, the Roman Church basically ruled Europe, most of Europe at least. And so the images on the cards, like you'll see nowadays, you'll see the high priestess, you know, on the card. Well, the original tarot cards, it wasn't a high priestess. It was the papess, or the female pope. And the hierophant that you'll see in modern decks was the pope. And all the imagery, everything from like the Last Judgment to the sun and the moon and the way these celestial objects and symbols are portrayed throughout the tarot, it's Christian iconography. So I, you know, the fact that a lot of people today are scared of tarot because they think it's some weird, you know, pagan invention, luring people into witchcraft and things like that. It's not. It's iconography, and symbolism is overtly Christian, because that's what it arose from, a Christian culture in Northern Italy. So why did they put those cards in there? It was just to make the game more fun. And whereas, you know, nowadays, if we were designing our own tarot deck, we might use kind of cultural symbols and images and things like that drawn from our culture. That's why you see so many strange tarot decks today, like, you know, the Walking Dead tarot. I'm just kind of making that up, you know, but it probably exists, because any sort of set of symbols or TV show or movie or fantasy series. People draw from those sorts of sources and make their own tarots. But the culture in that period was, you know, they didn't have TV. They didn't have, you know, lavish printed books in most people's homes. You know, the imagery that you saw was going to church. So their lives were kind of wrapped up in this, you know, very Christian, very Catholic mythology. So that's why the images on those cards were very religious. And for the most part, the imagery draws. Now there are some kind of pagan elements perhaps, because during the late Middle Ages and the early Renaissance, a lot of people were getting interested in the Greek classical culture and Roman classical culture and things like that. But for the most part, you know, tarot, as it originally was created, was a game played for fun and for betting money and winning. And the iconography was explicitly Christian.
So how did it become what it is today and how people use it? Like, where was the change from just playing some sort of entertainment or game?
Well, tarot was played as a game and only as a game, as far as we know, up until about the 18th century. So for a very long time, it was just a game. And as a matter of fact, if you, in some places in Europe today, including Italy, people still play Tarocchi. So this game is still played. And there's even an app you can get on your phone.
Of course.
to learn how to play Tarocchi. But it's kind of complicated. I never really wrapped my head around it. And I never could get, people to play. They would much rather play regular card games than try to learn this kind of obscure Italian variant of a card game. Right, exactly. But what happened is, during the early 18th century, up through the next 75, 80 to 100 years, Freemasons are the reason that we have tarot as a divination tool today. And because in that era, a lot of Freemasons were very much into esotericism. There's not as much of that today. Like, Freemasonry is kind of a more social club than anything. But back in the day, a lot of wealthy men, aristocracy, who had a lot of time on their hands because, you know, they didn't have to just go to work every day like most of us do. They could sit around and debate, you know, esoteric ideas, alchemy and Kabbalah and Egyptian history and hieroglyphics and things, because the Rosetta Stone had not been found yet. So people projected all sorts of stuff onto Egyptians and Egyptian hieroglyphics. So some of these Freemasons, really deep into this esoteric, Western esotericism very broadly. Someone found the cards. His name was Antoine Cour de Gebelin, and he was a French Swiss Protestant pastor, but he was also a Freemason, like a lot of the learned gentlemen of the day. And he saw this countess playing a card game. He saw her playing tarot. And he was blown away. He's looking at these images and studying these images. And he's like, wait a minute. This must have come from ancient Egypt. Because they thought everything came from all Western esotericism. These guys were just like building these ornate mythologies about Egypt that were not at all grounded in reality. So he wrote a book, basically called The Primitive World and Its Relation to the Modern World. Really long, complicated title. But this book said that tarot had come from ancient Egypt. and it caught on fire among these European gentlemen Freemasons who loved this stuff. So they devoured it. He also was the first to say he noticed that there were 22 of these tarot trump cards or major cards. And he said, oh, guess what? There are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. So therefore, what must have happened is the Jews got their hands on the tarot cards and the tarot. He just started building this elaborate story. Like, well, clearly these 22 images were like ancient wisdom. And then the Jews got their hands on it when they were, you know, enslaved in Egypt, and they added the Kabbalah to it. So added Kabbalistic meanings to these cards. So, you know, these guys just built this really elaborate mythology, and it caught fire, and it just started spreading. And these esoterically inclined Freemason guys took a bunch of cards that were simply used to play a game and made them into this like repository of ancient wisdom. And people believed it because they didn't have, you know, they didn't have scholarship to prove otherwise. So this idea just caught on, and it just spread and spread and spread. And the idea that the tarot is the ancient book of Thoth, you know, that the god Hermes who spread wisdom, ancient Hermetic wisdom. And, you know, it was like a snowball. This thing just kept rolling and rolling and rolling and picking up all sorts of, you know, esoteric stuff that people would pack onto this snowball. And it just kept going and going and going until when it really took off. And one man who really made a difference in this, his name was Alphonse Louis Constant. He was French. He changed his name to Eliphas Levy because he was a Kabbalist. He was he used the Christianized Jewish Kabbalah, and he was like a real mystically inclined guy. He was a Freemason. He was a ceremonial magician too, and he wrote a book that's still in print today. It's called Transcendental Magic. And it wove the Kabbalah and angel magic and ceremonial magic and alchemy and astrology, just crammed it all together and kind of made it make sense. And he decided the tarot was also part of the system. And it's like in a lot of books of magic, some books are entirely made up of tables of correspondences, they're called. So if you buy these ancient magic grimoires and stuff, it'll tell you like, oh, well, this flower is associated with the sun and this particular stone and things like that. Well, Eliphas Levy kind of was like the man who pulled all Western esoteric traditions together and like crammed it into these little charts and things. And he pulled the tarot into that. And what he influenced a group called the Golden Dawn, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. I don't know if you've talked about them on your show before, but without this kind of strange, but extremely influential English-British Hermetic Brotherhood, or I should say Brotherhood and Sisterhood, we probably wouldn't be even using tarot cards today. This was a group that kind of grew out of esoteric Freemasonry and then became this really powerfully influential secret occult order around I think 1888 was when the first temple was established. William Butler Yeats, the Irish poet, was a member. Dion Fortune, the famous occultist, was a member, and the bad boy of occultism, Aleister Crowley, he was also part of the Golden Dawn. So all like modern magical traditions that kind of grew out of those older Hermetic traditions come from the Golden Dawn. So like people who practice Thelema, follow Aleister Crowley's religion, his revealed religion of Thelema. It all goes back to the Golden Dawn. Like, it was just like the cream of the crop, the intelligentsia of the end of the 19th century British. Yeah, I mean, it just drew in like poets and artists and theater people and things like that, writers. It really was a tremendously creative and just influential order. Like, all modern Western magical traditions pretty much can kind of sprung from the Golden Dawn. And they took the tarot cards and they even went further. You know, they like kind of at the root of the Golden Dawn magical system is the tarot. The tarot and its Kabbalistic correspondences really are like the basis with the whole Golden Dawn magical tradition was built around.
As we start getting into this and people like Aleister Crowley and stuff, it starts being kind of an occult thing. How did it turn into something that people consider so evil or consider it to be, you know, something of witchcraft or something like that?
Right. Well, I think so what happened is the Golden Dawn, out of the Golden Dawn came two individuals, Arthur Edward Waite and Pamela Coleman Smith. So for most people, when they think of tarot, they think of the what's sometimes known as the Waite-Smith, people call it now, the Rider Waite, it was known as, because Rider was the publisher and Waite was the kind of the author and the mastermind behind this tarot deck. It's the one you see in movies and TV all the time.
Right.
And Pamela Coleman Smith was the artist, and she's a fascinating character in her own right. I've done some talks just on Pamela Coleman Smith, the artist of the Rider Waite, or we like to call it the Smith Waite or the Waite Smith deck, just so she kind of gets credit, because, you know, it's the art that draws people in. It's the art that really makes the cards what they are. So that Rider Waite deck, that's the one you see all the time in movies and films, and it's the images, you know, that, you know, you open up the Led Zeppelin album and there's the Hermit, you know, it's kind of drawn from the Smith Waite deck. And that started getting, that was first published, I think, 1910 or something. And it didn't really kind of blow up in popularity until like the 1960s, when suddenly these decks became mass produced and they were available in the U.S. and across Europe, where a lot of people in Europe still use some of the older decks, and Marseille tarot, they're called. And that's kind of my favorite, because I'm a kind of a historical tarot buff. But it's the Rider Waite or Smith Waite deck that really kind of blew up in popular culture. And I think the reason it's associated with kind of witches and things like that is just this people didn't have the facts. So they made up all sorts of stories. So a lot of people would say that, and many still believe this and will tell you this, that the tarot came from Egypt and it was kind of carried by the gypsies, or more commonly known as the Roma, or appropriately known as the Roma today. But it was all this, the idea that gypsies, because gypsies were associated with fortune telling and divination, that's where a lot of that bogus history comes from, is people associating, and most of the Roma used regular playing cards because that's what they had. So they did use cards, but they weren't tarot cards. But in the 60s, these decks start becoming available, and there's like an occult explosion, the 60s and 70s, but it really got moving in the 60s, like the Age of Aquarius, and people feeling liberated from traditional religion and wanting to explore alternative spiritual systems and things like that. So, you know, witchcraft became popular and occultism became really popular. Occult bookstores started popping up in major cities like New York City and San Francisco and things like that. And this kind of birthed what later became the New Age, you know, what a lot of us know as the New Age. But tarot was a big part of that. You know, people were fascinated by these you know, these powerful images with strange symbols in them. And because the Rider-Waite, which became the most approachable and easy to find deck across the United States and in the UK as well, and in some parts of Europe too.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Because that Waitsmith deck came out of the Golden Dawn tradition, it had occult symbols in it. Like instead of the coins in the older decks, there were pentacles that had pentagrams. And that immediately triggers a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
You know, you see a pentagram, you know, some people just start having palpitations.
Yeah.
But so because the deck had kind of occult symbols in it, and it was embraced by this new sort of new agey occult awakening in the United States in particular, the cards lent themselves to all sorts of interpretations. And even though there's still a lot of Christian symbolism, because Arthur Edward Waite was he still considered himself kind of a Christian, even though he practiced magic. So he didn't like the magic stuff in the Golden Dawn. He didn't like the ceremonial magic. He kind of he believed that, you know, prayer was more important, but still that studying these the Kabbalah and alchemy and astrology and things like that, he fit that in with Christianity. But if you look at like the Ace of Cups in the Waitsmith deck, there's the paraclete or a dove with the consecrated host in its mouth coming down into a chalice, you know, and there's crosses all over it too. So, you know, for as much as people think that the Rider-Waite or the Waitsmith deck is like just some, you know, occult tome of wisdom, there's still plenty of Christian iconography in it because it came again out of that original Christian iconography and symbolism. So the short answer would be, I would say that the tarot became associated with this kind of booming occult You know, and the paranormal and things like that. I mean, all that stuff really kind of blew up in the 60s and then rolled through the 70s as well. That's, you know, I'm a kid of the 70s. So, I remember seeing tarot decks sold in, you know, some of the kind of, you know, stranger stores that I would go to in some of the early New Age bookstores. And, you know, books on witchcraft were like in the little paperback, mass market paperback racks and things like that in the 70s. So this stuff really blew up. And that's why I think tarot was part of that revolution, that alternative spiritual revolution. And it became associated with all those other elements. Witchcraft in particular, because tarot never really had anything to do with witchcraft until like the 60s and 70s, when people who called themselves witches, which is, you know, kind of a modern thing that began in like the mid to late 1940s in England. That's the witchcraft that exists now really kind of originated then. But people who were telling fortunes naturally took up the tarot and started, you know, telling fortunes and using it for divination. And here we are.
Now, are people still using it the same way as they were, let's say, 100 years ago?
Yeah, in some ways, yes. When it started to be used for divination and it began to spread through Europe, a lot of the European readers, you still just use those 22 major cards, the ones with like the real vivid pictures on them, and don't use the rest of the cards, the other 56 cards of the deck. They just use those 22 major cards because it's a little easier to tell stories with those pictures, like the hermit or the lovers and the hanged man, things like that. It's easier to tell stories, and that's what tarot reading is. It's a back and forth kind of storytelling exercise. But the Waite Smith deck, that was a little different because each of those cards, instead of the Three of Cups, it would actually have a picture with three cups and people doing something. So each of those minor cards, which in the older decks were just, you know, two coins, five cups, six swords, in this Waite Smith deck, there are pictures, there are people doing things, sometimes really vivid pictures, like the Three of Swords card is three swords like piercing a human heart. And it's so, you know, it's a lot more evocative than just, you know, three swords sitting on a card by themselves. So that's what's really changed the way that a lot of people read, especially in the U.S., because the Smith-Waite deck had just all these scenes on them, which opened up 78 possibilities versus just using those 22. But I think, you know, even some of the earliest uses of divination, you know, going back to like the 18th century, when people started playing around with these cards in a way that was more than just a game. I think, and my theory is, and I think it's probably fairly well supported, is that whenever you have a whole bunch of images, you know, whether it's playing cards or, you know, a book or something like that, they lend themselves to thinking about is in a divination sense. So let's say bibliomancy, like people used to take a Bible and ask a question, like flip to a page in the Bible and, you know, pop their finger down and read that particular quote. So it's hard for me to imagine, even though there's not a lot in the historical record, that these cards were always used in some divinatory way, you know, because they're such powerful, evocative images, and games lend themselves to chance and probability and what's going to come next, you know, what card are you going to turn over next? And that that kind of randomness and that mix of images always like that, that does something to people, you know, like you're like waiting to see what that next card is. That kind of triggers a sense of like fate, if that makes sense, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I feel like these cards have always been used in that way, but there's not a lot in the historical record again until the, like the Freemasons started, you know, getting involved and playing around in some of these esoteric and occult orders. But people, I think divination has always been with us, you know, I mean, back to the, you know, the Greeks talking about, you watch how, you know, how the birds fly across the sky or something like that. I mean, we're naturally creatures who, you know, we seek messages, we seek omens. And when we have these like beautiful cards with these like really powerful images on them, you know, it makes it that much more of, you know, an intense experience. When, you know, you flip over the death card, I mean, people who read tarot know that, you know, that's not, that doesn't mean you're going to die. You know, most people would say it's change or the situation coming to an end, that sort of thing. But it's still a powerful image. You know, there's the Grim Reaper staring at you, or the lovers, you know, when you're just thinking about someone that you may be romantically interested in, you flip that lover's card, that does something to us. You know, even if we're not using the cards in a traditional divination sense, that's the way humans are. That's the way we react to images. We start making stories and relating those images to our lives.
So what can I expect if I go to a tarot reader, someone that does that? What can I truly expect out of that?
Well, that is a huge question because there's so many different styles of reading, you know. It's some people use these elaborate spreads of like, you know, 12 cards, and wherever you put the card that has a specific meaning and things like that, it can get really complicated. I mean, there's entire books on different spreads of cards. And there's also different ways people approach it. Like I don't necessarily, when I do readings for people, I tell them, I'm not telling you your future. You know, that's not what this is about. This is about the two of us sitting together and looking at some really powerful symbols and talking about what's going on in your life right now and seeing the patterns in these cards. Like, do these cards suggest ideas or thoughts or perhaps ways to approach a situation in your life or the way forward? So that's my kind of approach. But some people will, you will go to a reader and they will say that they're telling you your future. I mean, they will be a, you know, quote, fortune teller. And that's, you know, that's perfectly valid if that's what they like to do and if that's what the person going to them wants or expects. But there's just such a, the field has gotten so huge that you can go to one particular reader who might use a particular deck that might be a, you know, a Wiccan themed deck. So they're going to give you like a, you know, kind of a Wiccan style reading or use symbols aligned with that. There are people who you will go to a reading with and they will claim that they are channeling spirits or it's their spirit guides who are influencing the cards. There are some people that have a purely psychological approach and it's just like, hey, let's see what comes out of these pictures and we'll talk back and forth about it. Some people believe that the cards have energy to them. You know, I don't. I think it's cardboard and ink. But some people, you know, they go to elaborate ways of like cleansing their cards with salt or smoke and stuff like that. And that's cool. You know, I don't say don't do that. It's just not my thing. I would say if you're looking for a reader, like talk to people, ask if you can ask how they like what their style of reading is, because you might not want to go to someone who says, well, I'm going to lay out your whole future for the rest of your life for you. You know, you might not want to go to someone who has a particular approach, or a particular religious or spiritual approach, you know. So really, it's kind of like, I kind of look at it as auditioning people, you know, like ask about how they read and what their style of reading is. And if it sounds like it clicks with you, then give it a shot. There are so many readers out there now that, I mean, it's overwhelming, the number of people who even professionally read cards, not to mention just people who do it like for fun or a hobby. It's exploded in popularity. So you will never run out of people who will read your cards for you. But I think it's always good to find someone that you like and that you click with, and that you kind of, you're sort of spiritual, or even, you know, even if you're more of like a psychologically oriented person, you might like that kind of reader. If you're a more sort of new agey person and you're into channeled beings and spirit guides and things like that, then you could find a reader who kind of, you know, has that flavor of reading. So it's all over the place. And there is no one right way or wrong way to do it. The way I tend to do my readings, if I'm doing short readings with people, I use three cards. I only use the 22 major cards. I used to read with like the Waite-Smith deck and other decks that have all those other scenes on the cards. But there's a weird paradoxical thing that happened is when I started using just those 22 major cards, my readings got so much better. It's like paradoxical, because you would think, well, you've got this whole deck of 78 cards. Why would you just use 22? But that's the way it works for me. So I often do readings with three cards. And I will have someone, if they have a question, they can ask the question. We can look at the cards and see what the cards suggest. Or sometimes a lot of people, especially if they don't know you and they're coming for a reading for the first time, I say, well, let's just throw some cards down and see what comes up. So I'll put three cards down, maybe four, depending on the time. And I'll just start talking. I'll say, well, we've got the Emperor here. That's usually like a man, often an older man, someone of power in your life, like father figure or boss, etc. And here we've got the Lovers. And well, that can mean, you know, a couple or people in love. And I just go on and I talk about some things. And then I say, does any of that click? Does any of that, and in the position of the cards too, like I look at it as almost like a little mini comic book. You know, like each card is like a frame of a comic book and it tells a story. Mm. And it's amazing with three cards. Like I can have a conversation with someone for, you know, 30, 40 minutes sometimes and get some really interesting material out of it. And that's what blows my mind. Like, you know, I'm a pretty scientific guy. But at the same time, I have to admit that these cards, doing this thing that we call a tarot reading, bringing your intention to this experience, asking some questions maybe, or having a question in mind, but just bringing your intention and to these random, evocative, kind of powerful images and mixing them all up and pulling a few out at random and having a conversation with someone across the table, it's magic. You know, it's really interesting stuff comes out of that. And I don't know how. You know, I don't think I'm particularly psychic or anything. I think anyone can do this. I teach people to do this and then they do it and they go, wow, I can do this. And I'm not psychic and they're not psychic, or maybe we're all psychic and we don't know it. I don't know. But you don't have to be psychic to put some images on the table and talk about them with somebody. And talk about how these images could relate to their life. It works. And crazy stuff comes out of it, like weirdly accurate details about what's going on in someone's life. And I have absolutely no idea how that happens. But if you start doing this, you'll find that it happens. Like, it happens a lot. And that's the fascination of this exercise that we call reading tarot cards.
So when it happens, so in essence, the person using the tarot cards to do the reading could be using it from their Christian point of view or from their pagan point of view or Egyptian or just no point of view at all, considering a religion, but they're still use the cards and it still creates the outcome.
Exactly. It doesn't matter what your spiritual or religious beliefs, if you have any at all, if you sit down and play with these images and sit, you can read for yourself too. That's another myth I always run into. Oh, you can't read for yourself. Of course you can read for yourself. Like, how are you going to know how to read for someone else? Like, you look, ask a question, take out a couple cards and start seeing patterns and thinking in symbols and having a conversation with yourself. I think it's critical to read for yourself and to get to know the cards and to get to know how the meaning of those cards can change through time and in different situations. So yeah, you can be someone who has absolutely zero belief in divination or magic or occultism or paganism or whatever. I mean, you could be I did a reading for a doctor once, and this guy, his family sort of had a party for him, and they said, oh, it'd be kind of fun to have a tarot reader. So they hired me to do it. And I sat down with this guy, and he said, I don't believe in any of this stuff. And I said, that's fine. You don't have to believe in anything. It's just an experience, and let's just see where it goes. And I started reading these cards for him, and some of his family members started kind of coming over and hanging and listening and everything. And then more and more of them came over, and I was watching this guy. I'm just kind of saying things that come up, and it moved him deeply. You know, his eyes grew teary, and he thanked me. He said, I don't believe in this, but that was a really powerful experience for me. Thank you. And his family were really engaged in the process. And so that told me a lot. That told me that you don't have to believe in all the woo-woo that gets associated with tarot cards. You can just view it as a conversation that two people are having while looking at these beautiful, evocative, symbolic pictures, almost like therapy in a way. And for a lot of people, they go to tarot readers because they're having problems. That is why most people go to a tarot reader. Now, some just like to go to get insights into their life, and they regularly go to readers and things like that. But a lot of times people will say, I'm stuck. My love life is in the toilet, and my job's falling apart, and I just don't know what to do. What the heck? I'll go to some sort of psychic reader, and they find a tarot card reader. And so for a lot of people, that experience is kind of therapeutic. But at the same time, I draw really, really firm lines in my readings, and I encourage other readers to. I don't do medical questions. I'm not a doctor, right? If I can't put down a couple cards on the table and tell you that, you know, your appendix is going to burst or you need a heart transplant, and I don't do pregnancy questions for, I think, obvious reasons, but a lot of readers do that. Yeah. And I think, look, what if you say this birth is going to be absolutely perfect? It's going to be a beautiful boy. He's going to grow up to be an astronaut or something. And then, you know, God forbid the pregnancy terminates somehow. And that person, how can you as a reader look that person in the eye if you've told them something like that and something tragically happens? I don't do it. I advise other readers not to do that. Medical, pregnancy, I also don't like when people come to me and say, I'd like to get into the head of my boyfriend. Like, what's he thinking? Is he cheating on me? I mean, that's one of the most common questions. And I'll tell you, I don't even have to put the cards down. If someone says, I think my boyfriend or my girlfriend's cheating on me, they are.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you have those suspicions, I mean, maybe not. But if you're worried that something's wrong, almost all the time, yeah, there is something wrong. So I don't do that. I don't read for other people in the third person. But what I do say is, oh, you're having trouble in the relationship. Let's put some cards down and see if they suggest anything you can do. I always try to, you know, give agency back to the person that I'm reading for. And and if someone is really in a crisis, I have a list of mental health hotlines and things like that. And I say, you don't need a tarot reading. Like, you need to talk to a professional that can help you out. I'm not that person.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and if they have a relationship thing and you pull over the death card,
Yeah, I think it's okay to talk about relationships. And let's say the death card does come up. That might not mean that the relationship is dead, or the relationship that could mean that the relationship as it was is dying or coming to an end. But that could mean a positive new change. And that might depend on the other cards that also show up in the reading as well. So I'm happy that people ask questions about things, but I never say this is the way it is. I say, these are some possibilities for you to think about.
Right.
And I always push it back on the person. This is about you, where you are now, not the future you necessarily. This is you right now. Let's look at these cards and talk about where you are right now and where you want to go. And maybe these cards will give us maybe a little roadmap, maybe, or a little kick or a nudge in a particular direction. But always, it's the person's own agency and volition. They are in charge of their life. And I, as a reader, am there to help them get better insight. Like, tarot can be seen as a mirror in a way. So they're looking at these cards, but what they're really seeing is themselves reflected in those cards. That's the ideal metaphor for me. And I'm just helping them by pulling out maybe some meaning or some possibilities and throwing it back at them and see how they react and what they think about it. And they feed back to me too. When I'm in a reading, I say, does that card make you think of anything? And I learn from that. And sometimes that's just exactly what we need for that sort of breakthrough to happen.
Wow. Totally interesting. So are you still doing classes and things like that for people right now? Or
thanks to COVID, I stopped doing my in-person classes.
Okay.
But I'm starting my first in-person class again. I'm so excited because I've done a lot of Zoom classes. People can go to my website, michaelmhughes.com, and sign up for my newsletter, and you'll get all my classes when they happen, the Zoom classes. If you live in the Baltimore, D.C. area, my in-person classes I'm doing again. I occasionally will travel if someone wants to host me and do some classes at a store or some kind of center or something like that. I do that as well. But I'm really excited to do the in-person classes because there's just something about that. Because at the end, I usually do them in three chunks. The first set is the history. The second is getting to know the cards. And the third section of these classes is when people read for each other. And it's hard to do that via Zoom. The breakout rooms don't necessarily lend themselves to that. And it's just, there's something about the in-person connection when you're sitting. So I have my students pair up when we're in person. And they read for each other, and they're usually terrified. This is my third class, and you're telling me to read for the. And I say, just do it the way I talk about, and they do it, and they're blown away, and they most of the time they're shocked at how much fun they're having, but also kind of the good, meaningful stuff that's coming out of their very first reading that they've done. So, I encourage anyone who's interested in my online classes just to go to my website and sign up for my newsletter, and you'll get the next online series of classes I'm doing will be in March. So that gives people plenty of time to think about it and plan their schedules accordingly. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's really fun. I love teaching. I love doing readings. I like having people read for me. It's endlessly fascinating, and it just opens a window into other people. And I think so many of us have kind of missed that during this global pandemic, where we've been just dealing with people through screens so much. It's just such a magical experience to sit down physically with someone and take these cards out and talk to each other. It's just, I think so many of us are missing that.
Yeah. Well, fascinating. We will have that up on our website as well, so people listening can find you if they don't remember. Just one click. Wow.
Great.
It's been great. We've been talking about tarot, and our guest is Michael Hughes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. As always, bring me back anytime. I love the show, and I love our conversation. So,
to find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.